So welcome everybody to the fifth of our series of talks on sessions on early Buddhism. And for this week, or this month, we're going to be looking at the quality of wisdom. And in many ways, the idea of wisdom is perhaps the most characteristic quality for developing Buddhism. The word Buddha itself means awakened, means someone who has wisdom. And in the qualities which are to be developed in Buddhist practice, wisdom is always regarded as being the highest of those things, most important. And so while we find wisdom traditions, of course, in every philosophy, every religion, every spiritual tradition, as very characteristic of Buddhism, of the wisdom tradition is highly developed. It's very detailed, it's very clearly analyzed and so on. So because the topic covers a very wide range of territory, and obviously we're going to be able to only cover a few things today, for this morning I'm going to look at some general principles, a bit of an overview about wisdom. And then this afternoon we'll have a look more specifically at some of the suttas, and see what the suttas are saying on the topic of wisdom. So, as usual, I'm trying to spice up my very boring PowerPoint presentations by putting a few random images in there, which are simply what Google gave me when I said early Buddhism wisdom. Okay, so it gave me a bunch of images. These are some of them. So the tree, actually, that's a very important one, and I was very glad that this one came up, because the tree is a very good symbol for how wisdom works in Buddhism. And you can see that you have, what you see of the tree is a lot of the diversity, right? You see each leaf, each leaf is individual and is unrepeatable. But they all follow a similar pattern, and if you can follow that pattern back, they will lead to the same trunk. So this is somehow this idea that there's a diversity of experience, like what we actually experience in the world, what we experience in meditation, what we experience in life. But then somehow there's one trunk, so there's one unifying way of understanding it. There's one whole that we can come back to that will let us understand all of these things. But of course, if we look at that unifying whole, then that leads to the roots. Where does it come from? And interestingly enough, the roots themselves then split out in the same way, aren't they? So there's many different causes, many different conditions at work. Many different results, So the causes, where things come from, is very diverse and very complex. Where they end up is, again, very diverse and very complex. But if we understand the trunk, if we understand the principle, how things work, then we can understand how these things are related. So this is one of the ways that we can understand the imagery of the tree as the tree of wisdom, or the Bodhi tree. Okay, so now when we look at wisdom, or we think about the topic of wisdom, we're thinking about a kind of knowing. But of course, knowing is something which has many different levels, right? And this is something I think which we can all kind of roughly understand. You can start at a very trivial level with data, okay? And then you sort of can synthesize that data to make some more meaningful information. And perhaps at a more deeper level than information would be something like knowledge. And somebody who knows how to, again, put together all the knowledge well is somebody who's said to have understanding. And at an even deeper level is something like wisdom. And I think what you find when you look at what characterizes these different levels of understanding is something about the idea that at each stage we're bringing things together, there's an idea of synthesis Yeah, rather than all the little bits of things, which is what data is, right? These little bits and pieces of things. And there's a gradual process of being able to actually see everything as one, or being able to accommodate everything that you find. And so to me, this is where those expressions of very deep wisdom come from. If you look in some of the things the Buddha said, he'd take a very simple wisdom statements of the Buddha, like the first line of the Dhammapada, Manopubhangama Dhamma. Yeah, all dhammas, all things are led by the mind. Yeah? So it's a very simple statement, it's a very profound statement. Yeah? But it can apply to so many different things. When you have that one bit of wisdom, you can then use it to assimilate so many different other kinds of things. Whereas data has a very limited use, right? You have one bit of data, someone's birthday. Well, that's useful in one specific context, but it's completely useless everywhere else. So to me, this is something about that idea of a wisdom. It's something where you have an insight that will apply everywhere, a profound insight that will apply everywhere. And something about that was captured, I always remember saying, by Niels Bohr, one of the foundational quantum theorists, and of course the quantum physicists Niels Bohr and those guys were very kind of out there in terms of their philosophy. But he said something along the lines that the opposite of a shallow truth is a falsehood, but the opposite of a deep truth is another deep truth. Yeah, which I think is very interesting. Yeah, interesting way of looking at it. So kind of a classic example of that would be one example I saw given for that is you can say life is short. Yeah. But you can also say life is long. Depends where you look at it, yeah? It's a whole glass half full thing, yeah? So the opposite of a deep truth is another deep truth. So from the characteristic of wisdom, one of the things that implies from the characteristic of wisdom is that you don't get so fussed about contradictions. Yeah. So at those kind of more shallow levels, like if you look at the level of data, well, it's either zero or one. That's it, you know. And even information and things, you're either born on this day or that day, right? And you have to get it right. What are you going to put? What's your birthday? You have to have a number. Well, actually, I was born at midnight. Right? And the real world doesn't quite fit in to that idea that data has to be either one or the other, right? These kinds of things happen all the time. So as our understanding becomes deeper, then one of the characteristics of that is that our ability to cope with ambiguity and contradiction and paradox becomes much greater. Yeah? We can live with and cope with a world where there are shades of grey. Okay. So as I go along, as always with the questions and so on, if anybody has any questions, then please feel free to ask. But generally during the main group discussions, we try to keep the questions to things which are to the point of what we're talking about. And more in-depth discussions we'll have in the discussion groups. Okay, so here I've committed the very foolish act of trying to define wisdom. Perhaps wisdom could be defined as that which does not try to define things that are indefinable. Anyway, an act of understanding that generalizes from immediate experience to encompass the whole of what is possible. So this is just a throwaway definition. But there's a few parts of the definition which I'd like to draw your attention to. One is that it's an act of understanding. So wisdom is not something which is something in a sense that you possess. It's something that you do. Yeah? And I think this is something which our language constantly misleads us. By using nouns to talk about these things, yeah? So we use the noun wisdom. Actually, it's a bit awkward when we're translating from Pali because the word we're using, panya, is the usual word we're translating when we say wisdom, but it's very commonly used in the verbal form, but we don't really have a verb for wisdom. Right? So one you could say perhaps one wises up or something like that, yeah? But you can't really have a verb for wisdom. But wisdom is an act of understanding, okay? It's something that your mind does. Okay? So what that means is that it's not the case that some people have wisdom and some people don't, right? It depends how you use your mind. And people who have wisdom don't necessarily have it all the time, right? Sometimes you're wise and sometimes you're stupid. And the fact that somebody is wise in some cases by no means implies that they're going to be wise all the time, right? So it's an act of understanding. So, and then this other idea that it generalizes from immediate experience. So what I'm talking about here is this idea of what they sometimes call induction or inference, where you take what is presented to you and then you can draw a general truth from that. Okay? So think about some of the expressions of wisdom which the Buddha is very famous for, a very, very basic one, something like sabbe sankhara anicca, all conditions are impermanent. So it's an expression of wisdom. So how did the Buddha arrive at that? Okay? Did he actually see all conditions? Right? Has he actually personally witnessed every single conditioned activity that's ever happened in the universe and that is happening now and that ever will happen? Is he watching two dust motes fly past each other or 3 light years off Alpha Centauri and noticing how that they condition each other impermanently? Is that how he actually arrived at that? Well, of course not. So he arrived at that from his own experience, from what he did know, what experience in his life, and then he infers from that, okay? So this is similar to, in a way that science works. So you infer, you develop this hypothesis, and then you apply it. And you see what the results are, and you test it. So wisdom, in a sense, makes quite a bold claim within Buddhism, the whole of what is possible. And so, in a sense, we're talking about things that are not just provisionally true, not just true here and now, but are true in any possible world, okay? So, again, to think of that idea like impermanence, okay? And if we look at, say, the worlds of Buddhism and Buddhist cosmology, then you can have sort of countless world systems, and, you know, they talk about the 10,000-fold world system and so on and so forth, and then many eons and collapsing eons and new world systems and all of those kinds of things. But through all of that process, no matter how big the scope that you look at, you'll always see impermanence. And it's the same thing if you look from a scientific point of view, yeah? And no matter how wild the theories and the speculations of science become, you know, parallel universes and dark matter and all of these kinds of things, they're all impermanent in a sense. Yeah? And we never escape that idea of impermanence. One of my favorite physicists we were discussing recently in Bodhnyana is a fellow called Lee Smolin, who has a theory we call loop quantum gravity. And one of the ideas that he has, which I really like, is that the laws of physics themselves are impermanent. Okay? So even things like the speed of light or the mass of a proton or Planck's constant and things like that will change, and they evolve according to the laws of natural selection as universes evolve. So we don't have to see every single instance of that. We have to generalize in a meaningful way from our own experience to be able to understand things. So, now, one of the points of this, and I think something which is really critical for understanding how wisdom works in early Buddhism, is that whether that wisdom is perfect is not the issue. Okay? And in this sense, Buddhist approach to wisdom is quite different from the Greek philosophical approach to wisdom. If we look at the Platonic tradition, the Socratic tradition, the idea was that through using reason that you can arrive at a perfect depiction of the truth. Okay? So the classic example being geometry, right? So you can know, for example, that a straight line is the shortest distance between two points, right? And we know that axiomatically, much more accurately than if we ever measured it. Right? So you can never actually measure a perfectly straight line, right? It's always slightly approximate. But we know from the theory of geometry that a straight line is the shortest distance between two points, okay? And we arrive at that through a process of reason, okay? Which, incidentally, for Socrates, reason was the means which we elicited our memory of the knowledge that we learned in past lives. So this is actually how we came to know these things. But so this is how we arrive at knowledge in the Greek tradition. So this idea that we arrive at this absolute and perfect form of knowledge. Of course, it's slightly problematic because since Einstein came along and said, well, actually the straightest distance between two points is a curve. So that's not quite true anymore. But anyway, but the point of that philosophically is that you can arrive at a perfect idea of the truth. Okay? And in the Western philosophical tradition, there's been this to-ing and fro-ing between this rational approach of the Socratic tradition and the empirical approach, which has become much more popular in recent years. But in either case, the idea is that we can arrive at some perfect representation of the truth. From a Buddhist point of view, at least from early Buddhism, not so much from later Buddhism, but from early Buddhism, that's not the point, right? The point isn't to say, is this the absolute truth? Is this the perfect truth? Okay? The point is to say, how does it work? Right? It's a functional truth. And this is absolutely crucial for understanding how the Buddha approached wisdom, approached understanding. It's a functional truth. It's a pragmatic truth. It's good enough for its purpose. Of course, the purpose is freedom from suffering. Right? So the question, is this the ultimate, final, one and only perfect expression of truth, is meaningless. The only thing that's meaningful from a Buddhist point of view is, through this truth, do we find freedom from suffering? Okay? So the wisdom, because of that, the wisdom is purely a functional thing, and it's part of that process. And we've seen how that process works through the different workshops in this course, beginning with ethics, meditation, and then leading to wisdom. Wisdom itself is not the final end. Wisdom leads to freedom. So if the wisdom leads to peace of mind, leads to happiness, leads to freedom, yeah, leads to the ending of suffering, then it's right wisdom. That's the standard that we use. Okay, so maybe we should... Any questions on that?
Buddhism is a function of truth. It resonates extremely well. And I even wonder whether, in fact, there's no such thing as a perfect truth.
Well, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I'm coming on to that a little bit later on.
Because religions that talk about the perfect truth, I just can't grab it because there is no perfection. The truth is always relative.
Absolutely, yeah. And it becomes, the idea of the perfect truth, it's a bit fascistic, really. It's a bit like, you know, we've got control of what the reality is, you know, rather than, and if, you know, if you look at actually how things work, you know, if you look at any field of endeavor, you know, whether fixing cars or doing accounting or something like that, you know, it's never, this idea of absolute truth, it's not relevant. What's relevant is that you know enough to actually accomplish that function. Whether your understanding of this particular car is perfect or not is irrelevant. What matters is, can you get it going? Yeah.
On the definition, it strikes me that when you have friendship with the whole of what is possible, I was already, before you distinguish between the Western idea of wisdom and the Buddhist idea, I was thinking, well, the whole of what is possible, that means that we have to, that's to be, for wisdom, like we have to know the whole of what is possible. You know, it's like that seemed too big, and I was trying to work out how to qualify that. But perhaps what's important is to actually finish that with, you know, I don't know, some relative sort of statement that permits both. Like if it were in the Buddhist situation, you would say the whole of what is possible in order to reduce suffering.
Well, perhaps you could rephrase it as the whole of what is experienceable, or the whole of what is knowable.
Yeah, I think that would be a
Maybe that's better.
Yeah. I think that's probably better, because when we think of Buddha's wisdom, does seem to be, that seems to capture Buddha's wisdom, but I'm not sure that anyone but an arahant could get anywhere close to that.
Probably the whole of what is knowable might be a better way of putting it, yeah.
Yeah, because then that brings back to, yes, and that does bring it back to then the person having the experience rather than simply trying to objectify, I suppose.
Yeah, and you're understanding the nature of that experience. Mm. That's the point, yeah.
I was thinking of the fool's paradise. It does seem to be possible for some people to not experience suffering because they believe so strongly, perhaps perhaps I have a friend who believes in the Christian doctrine to such an extent that people die, doesn't make any difference. She's all this, well, it seems to be. So my understanding of wisdom was that there was something beyond the lack of suffering. It was an absolute truth that wasn't just signified by the fact that you didn't suffer anymore, because she doesn't seem to suffer.
Well, good on her, what can I say? Yeah.
She's lucky.
But that would seem to be more of a psychological thing rather than a philosophical. You know, she's just got a sunny disposition, so good on her.
But if you measure wisdom by whether or not it leads to the lack of suffering.
Yeah.
There might be a few people in the fool's paradise that would come into that being wise.
Maybe. Yeah, look, it's hard to say. I mean, my suspicion would be that I'm not quite sure what's around the corner, and that sometimes when people are like that, they might experience things in life later on which will challenge those assumptions, and then the very fact that they've been so blissful in their acceptance of them means that it's even harder for them to cope with. That's my suspicion, but I can't say I'd really be able to prove that. Yeah. Maybe that's just my own lack of mudita, or sympathetic joy for her happiness. Okay, so this is another thing that came up under Buddha wisdom. So sometimes people use Buddha's wisdom for things that are not necessarily what the Buddha was intending. Here's the Aqua Buddha, yeah.
To reduce suffering or something.
Anyway, with this attractive young man as our inspiration, let's do some meditation for the next 10 minutes. So I have to ask your forgiveness now, because this is supposed to be a course on early Buddhism, and I'm introducing here an idea from the commentary, so that's very bad, and purists will not stand for this kind of thing. But anyway, there are some things that you find in the commentaries and later traditions that are very useful, and this is one of the ideas that you find in the commentaries which I found has helped me understand. And what this does is this brings the different, and you actually find these ideas throughout the early suttas, and they're talking about wisdom, but they're not expressed in quite such a systematic way. And so this is like three stages in development of wisdom, especially relevant to when we're developing wisdom in meditation, but also in other contexts. And to me, this really kind of encaptures something which is very useful and helpful for us to understand how we go about developing wisdom. So the first one, jñāta pariññā, understanding the known. Second one, understanding by scrutiny, papīraṇa pariññā. And then the last one, understanding by letting go, pahāṇa pariññā. So understanding the known, relates, if you can excuse me, just go back in the thing. It relates a little bit to this kind of idea of this hierarchy or scale of knowing and understanding that I've mentioned a bit here. And when we talk about the three kinds, the Nyata Parinya is understanding the known. In a sense, this is information gathering. Okay? So this is the, you know, if you're doing your PhD, first of all, where you go out and do your research, you read the books and all of those kinds of things. Or if even if you don't read the books, at least you gather the bibliographic references so it looks like you've read the books. Some guilty chuckle here from people who've done their PhDs. Anyway, understanding that, but in meditation, what this refers to is something a bit more specific, and what it refers to is that when we're beginning a development of wisdom in meditation, we first do that by paying attention to those things that we're actually experiencing. So, for example, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touches, feelings, and so on and so forth. And we try to see those things as they are, right? So you try to see, okay, what is the quality of sight, for example? So we analyze, we break down the complex world of experience, and we say, well, what is sight like, right? What is that experience of seeing things like? And we investigate that, and we see sight as clearly as possible for what it is. So rather than saying, for example, I see a person, then you realize, well, you don't actually see people, you see light. Yeah? And then we can learn to distinguish between sight and sound, and you realize, well, sound is actually something which is completely different from sight. Yeah? They're two quite different kinds of things. And so this is the Nyata Parinya, where you're investigating what are the individual qualities of things as sort of distinct aspects of our experience. Nyata Parinya. And this is the beginning of the development of wisdom, especially wisdom as applied in meditation. Then the next one is what they call Akirana Parinya, understanding by scrutiny, and in a sense that's starting to connect these things. It's starting to look at the relationships between them, and often just described in terms of understanding the three characteristics, anicca, dukkha, anatta, or impermanent suffering and not self, or understanding dependent origination, understanding how one thing conditions another. Yeah? So for example, if we come back to that, then if you're doing the Nyata Parinya, you're doing meditation, for example, you might look at investigating sight, and you know, well, sight looks like this, light looks like this, colours look like this, this is what that consciousness, visual consciousness, this is how it works and this is what it's like. But then the Tirana Parinya, you might look at, for example, how do I respond when I see something? Okay? Ah, that sight evokes a certain feeling in me, and when I have that feeling, then I react to a pleasant sight by craving, or to an unpleasant sight by aversion, and so on. So it's investigating how these things are connected, or it might investigate, for example, how sight is connected to sound, right? So that when you see somebody talking, you realize you don't actually see somebody talking, what you see is light, and what you hear is sound, and then you put that together in your mind, and you invent this idea of a person who is doing the talking, and you put that back onto experience, right? So again, this is that process where you're reflecting, and through reflective meditation, you're beginning to understand how your experience is built up by the mind. And so this is a Tirana Parinya. So it's a deeper level of knowing. Yeah. And finally, understanding by letting go, right? And so this is the level of insight, where you actually see through these things and you let go and you're not attached to them anymore. Yeah? Of course, this is the most important one. So the interesting thing about, I think, these levels of knowing is to understand that the more profound kinds of insight are built up from the smaller things. And as always in Buddhism, things are progressive. Yeah? So we begin with the simple things. So we just ask ourselves those simple questions. So what is seeing like? Yeah? What is that consciousness of seeing like? And we investigate that. And as we come to a deeper and deeper knowledge of that, then gradually those more profound forms of knowing will emerge.
In the conventional thinking, wisdom actually has a lot to do with gathering and integrating and then we've got something very useful and good.
Right. But yeah.
Buddhism adds this deeper wisdom. So what's the wisdom in the letting go?
Well, if you were to look at it, say, from a conventional point of view, I usually come back to it from a conventional point of view, I come back to the only field of conventional knowledge which I really have, which is playing music. So a conventional idea of knowing is letting go. It means that when you're standing there on the stage and you're playing music, that you're not thinking about scales and chords and harmonies and so on, but you're just playing music. And all of that knowledge is nothing to be seen. But of course, it's still there. It informs everything that you do, right? But you're not actually thinking it at that time. It's just become part of who you are. Exactly, yeah. And it's the same thing in a Dhammic sense, it's, you know, that when those ideas of impermanence and so on are there, that is just natural, that you just, when you experience, when you relate to things, that you have that wisdom, that understanding is there from the beginning.
This is related to the simile of the raft, that when you reach the opposite shore, you can let go of the raft.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sensible to me.
That sounds roughly on track.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it's not exactly the way that we think about it from a Buddhist point of view, but yeah, that's a similar kind of idea, yeah. But the basic principle is that we're beginning with the smaller, more discrete and concrete knowing, and then we're moving towards systematic knowing, which is the understanding by scrutiny, and then to a sense where that's letting go, where that knowledge is actually... In a sense, where you're not accumulating knowledge anymore, but the knowledge is bearing its fruits.
It's integrated.
It's integrated, yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, if you're commenting on that, go on.
Because that seems to me suggesting, and I've often thought about this myself, this notion of to let go of that. Ego, or self, in other words.
Yeah.
Does that let go of the self, does that mean that we actually have to have a healthy sense of ego before we can actually let go of it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And I have to confess that for me, I used to think that, but then I began to realise that, that I could be going on forever until I got a truly healthy self ego. And maybe there's actually a compromise.
Well, yeah, I don't know about truly healthy ego, but healthy enough ego.
Yeah, healthy enough.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, but yes, so I think there is a risk in that thinking.
Sure.
So yes, that's a good one. So you've got to put a healthy enough
ego. Yeah, a relatively healthy ego. Yeah.
So healthy enough, I'm happy, yes.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Just about the two particles.
Yes, yeah, it's the same relationship as in English you have between family and familiar,
yeah.
Right? But the actual word means known.
Right.
Yeah.
Similarly, means decision in Sinhalese.
Oh, okay. Does
it have anything to do with
well, it's probably I guess it's probably derived from that. Yeah, but in this particular context. Really what it means is reflection on the relationships, reflection on the connections, or understanding the connections between things. Yeah.
And Prahana comes from Prahan?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. So that kind of leads on to, and some of the things we lead on to comes from what Lincoln was saying, and this idea of ultimate truth versus conventional truth. And I mention it here because it's so commonly talked about in pretty much every school of Buddhism, and I think it's a very, very misleading way of looking at things, and particularly I think it's misleading. It certainly is not something which we can find in the early Buddhist texts. So what actually is this ultimate truth and conventional truth, or ultimate reality and conventional reality? And so often it's described as like conventional reality is people, names, trees, or the idea of a self, basically, is what comes under conventions. Whereas what ultimately exists is dhammas, right? Phenomena of existence, which may be vedana or feelings or consciousness and so on and so forth. And so the idea is that often expressed is that we need to get beyond the conventional reality to experience the ultimate reality. And from the ultimate reality, we can find freedom. Now, there's a few reservations I have to make about that. First thing is that within the Theravadan tradition, in any case, I'm not quite sure about the other traditions, but within the Theravadan tradition, traditionally there's in principle no hierarchy between ultimate and conventional truth, that you can find liberation by either means. Okay? So this is the actual formally, the actual Theravadan point of view, although it's not actually what you find most or many Theravadan teachers expressing in modern times. But if you look in things like the Visuddhimagga and the Theravadan commentaries, this is what they will say. And there are plenty of examples of this. For example, when people become enlightened while they're hearing a teaching, for example, a teaching is operating at a level of conventional reality and people can become awakened by doing that. Or stories, as one of my favorite stories in the commentaries, of the monk who's walking through the town and then they hear, I think I might have mentioned this story before, they hear a slave woman singing a song about the sufferings of life. Yeah? Which is the blues, right? Okay? And then he's listening to the blues and gets enlightened. Right? So, there you go. So, within the tradition, within the Theravadan tradition, in any case, it's believed that, or it's said that through either conventional reality or through ultimate reality, that you can arrive at letting go and you can arrive at the truth. But even though that's in principle the case, in practice, it's almost always the ultimate reality is said to be like the real thing and conventional reality is dismissed. And this has a lot of kind of rhetorical functions within the Theravadan community and within other communities, and it justifies things. For example, it's often said that the Abhidhamma is at the level of ultimate reality and the suttas are at the level of conventional reality. So we can therefore essentially dismiss the suttas and focus on the Abhidhamma as being the real expression of the truth, and so on and so forth. So it's used in many of these kinds of ways. You find a similar kind of rhetoric in some forms of Zen and so on. But the distinction is not found at all in the suttas. And for the suttas, as Enkong was saying before, all truth is conventional. The only time that the Buddha used this word for ultimate truth, the word we use is paramattha satya, and it's used only one time in all of the Pali Canon and all of the early suttas, and in that case it's referring to nibbana. Yeah? So nibbana, we could say, is an ultimate truth because it's the ending of delusion. Right? The ending of ignorance. And so because it's the ending of ignorance, the flip side of that, it's the ultimate truth, we can say that. But any other kind of truth is purely conventional and purely pragmatic. One of the things, though, which this distinction was trying to get at, it's usually taught in the context of seeing, well, how do we talk about self and not self, right? So, for example, the Buddha talked about, you know, not self, and yet, you know, here we are, we've got people, and we have to sign our name on forms, and we have to address people, and we use names and things like that. So how do we understand that distinction? And so it said, well, from a conventional point of view, we talk about people and selves and so on, but at the ultimate level, those things don't exist, and only the dhammas exist. But what that does is that that gives the dhammas this thing as if they really truly exist. And this is very problematic on multiple philosophical levels, which, if you want to know about it, go and read Nagarjuna. But anyway, Nagarjuna came along and exploded this kind of thinking in ways that I think were very, very profound and very, very powerful, and which the traditions, the Theravadan tradition and other traditions which still insist on this kind of dichotomy, have never really responded to. And I've never seen in the 1500 years or more since Nagarjuna wrote his thesis, I've never seen a really meaningful response to that from anybody in the Theravada community or anybody in the other communities who try to maintain this distinction between ultimate and conventional reality. They basically have just kind of ignored it and hope it goes away. However, somebody who did respond to it was Vasubandhu. And again, I do have to apologize for this slight diversion from the topic of early Buddhism. So this is kind of middle period Buddhism. And Vasubandhu was following along from Nagarjuna, and he addressed this idea of this problem that we have. How do we talk about different aspects of the truth if we don't want to make this distinction between ultimate and conventional truth? And so he introduced this threefold division, which I think is much more interesting and much more useful than the usual kind of twofold ultimate and conventional reality. Unfortunately, this particular teaching of Vasubandhu is a very famous teacher in the Tibetan and Chinese traditions, but this particular treatise of his has been largely neglected. But this idea, you have the parikalpita, which is the imaginary, the paritantrika is the interdependent, and the parinishpana is the perfected. So the parikalpita, the imagined, is similar to the idea of conventional reality from the Theravadan point of view. So it means what is constructive and shaped by your mind. Yeah? What do you imagine with your thoughts and ideas and concepts and so on and so forth? This is all comes within the parikalpita. Imaginary is perhaps not quite the right translation. Perhaps the conceptual or conceived, constructed, something like that. Yeah, even constructed. Yeah. Paratantrika essentially corresponds to the realm of what falls within vipassana meditation in the Theravadan tradition, right? So it's seeing sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, feelings, contact, perception, all of these kinds of things. So when you see these aspects of reality directly, then this is what's called paratantrika. So it's felt to be a deeper or more precise way of seeing, but that's to say something's deeper or more precise is not the same as saying it's an ultimate reality, yeah? And so these are two quite different things. I mean, you think about it, for example, say if you compare with sciences, right? And we can think about how we treat materials and different kinds of materials, and we have words for plastic and so on and so forth. And we can look at chemistry, for example, and the chemists will have much more precise and specific ways of talking about what these materials are, what they're composed of and so on. But even their level of chemistry, of course, is not an ultimate reality, because underlying the chemistry of these things, there's a physics which describes how the subatomic particles work and so on and so forth. And where the physics is at, operating at an ultimate level, is purely a philosophical argument, right? We really just don't know. Physics can't tell us whether it's operating at any ultimate level, or indeed whether there is an ultimate level, or whether we just keep on going down and down and down and looking at more refined levels. That's a philosophical problem. That's not a scientific problem, right? So, yeah.
What's that term for things that say really are?
Yatha Bhuta Jnana Dasana.
Yeah, where
is that? A bit later, one of the next slides.
It seems to be many terms like Dhamma,
and
that,
and these
now.
Mm-hmm.
Are they really all different things? I mean, I would have thought that a term like things as they really are, that would pretty much do it.
No, that's wrong. But these are all we're looking at the same kind of thing from different angles. Yeah. So again, remember that process that wisdom works. So we try to instantiate that process or exemplify that process through the course. Right. We learn the little bits, but then we also bring them together and we understand how they fit together. But we have to learn the little bits first. The jnana parinya is what we're doing now. Later on, we can do the other parts. Yeah. So paratantrika is the interdependent. So you can think of that, on a physical level as being something like chemistry, yeah, of things. And the parinishpana is the perfected, and that's the level of realization or the level of nibbana, yeah, with letting go. So this is, again, the point here is not that there's one level which is conventional, one level which is ultimate, but that there are levels which are more and more precise and more useful for leading to that, that perfected or consummated, vision of the truth, which is the letting go of suffering.
Okay.
Yeah?
Are there two different directions operating here, like wisdom as synthesis,
uh-huh,
and wisdom as discernment?
Uh-huh.
So the say what you're going in the direction of ultimate reality, whatever you want to call it, is the sinner's discernment. And synthesis is the first definition of the sinner, a generalization.
A generalization, yeah, yeah.
I'm not saying they're separate.
Yeah, yeah. On the whole, wisdom moves towards greater level of synthesis. So the more wisdom, then the more you're able to synthesize different aspects of the truth within one framework.
Does it maybe mean that a rather simple-minded person gets earlier enlightened because she got earlier through her own contemplation than a person which really is eager to know a lot and wants to know a lot and wants to contemplate about a lot?
No. That's just wishful thinking. No, what it means is that as a generalization, right, as a generalization, the less wisdom you have, the more knowledge you have to have. And the more wisdom you have, the less knowledge you need. Yeah? And this is a kind of Sherlock Holmes phenomenon. Right? So if you think of Sherlock Holmes as being the paragon of wisdom, he sort of walks in and just needs to have a bit of knowledge. He can see the scuff of dirt on your shoes and the make of your handbag and the way that your collar is turned up and can immediately know everything about what you've done in the morning, right? And so that's somebody who has a lot of wisdom. So from a very small amount of information, they can draw a large amount of conclusions, yeah? As opposed to, say, someone like Google, right, who takes a huge amount of data, right, to deliver a trivial piece of information to you. Yeah? So Google takes billions and billions of pieces of data in order to tell me I have to leave at 5:15 to get to the airport in time for my flight this afternoon. Yeah? So the more wisdom you have, the better your conclusions from the less information. Yeah.
With the one before, the ultimate, my immediate thought was, well, but either of those, conventional or ultimate, both basically assume a self. So they neither of those transcend the notion of self. But I can't work out if that next view, that next notion of different levels of truth,
well, according to the tradition, the traditional explanation is that the delusion of self is what creates the conventional reality, and when you see beyond the idea of a self, you're seeing to ultimate reality.
But the
point, again, the point is, and I'm not trying to defend it, I'm just explaining what my understanding of the traditional position is, that by seeing this ultimate level of reality, that you undermine that sense of self, because you're looking at the things from which the self is built up from.
Right, so it's an implied definition. I was thinking, I can see why the distinction is not found in the syllabus, because I'm not sure that it's actually useful in terms of getting beyond self.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. And that was essentially was Nagarjuna's point of view as well, that he basically said that by making this kind of definition, that you think that you're going beyond self to not self, but in fact you're just reifying the entities at ultimate level become another level of the self.
That's what I was.
Yeah, and that was Nagarjuna's argument, basically.
Is he succeeding then?
Nagarjuna?
Yeah.
I think so. But
it seemed to me that I wondered if I was missing something.
Yeah.
It seems to me.
Yeah. Well, you can read Nagarjuna and decide whether he succeeds. Nagarjuna's somewhere around here.
So
No, no, Nagarjuna was a philosopher, Madhyamaka philosopher from about the 2nd century AD, who wrote one major treatise called the Mula Madhyamaka Karika. I'm just trying to see if I can see it now. Anyway, it'll be on the shelves. There'll be a few translations of the shelf on the shelves. A recommended translation or edition is by David Kalapahana. But Kalapahana.
Would you say that Tibetan Buddhism is mainly from Nagarjuna?
Definitely, yeah. The Dalai, like the Gelugpa school, which the Dalai Lama belongs to, is their kind of their ultimate philosophical position is basically that of, well, it's that of sort of developed from Nagarjuna. Yeah, they would say it's the philosophy of Nagarjuna, but whether it is exactly the same or not is a matter of somewhat disputable. But yeah, generally speaking. But of course, within the Tibetan tradition, they study all the different philosophical traditions, right? So they don't just study one or the other, but they look at all of them. Yeah. So
it's very Right.
Yeah, and I'm not sure whether that varies in the different Tibetan traditions. Yeah, I don't know enough about it to be able to say. Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. Which one? This one?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Right, that's at a deeper level, yeah. Yeah, so that first kind of understanding you're talking about there was the scrutiny, tirana, but then that leads to the pahana, abandoning.
But does this let you know also mean that you don't worry anymore about this certain subject? Like, if you would
contemplate Sure, just like a master musician doesn't say, how can I do a C major diminished scale? They just play music.
Like, to live in the past is no good because it's past. And to live in the future is not good because the future is not there and you can't really influence the future. And living in the present, it's also not very good because you have to do things which, like, or whatever. So you just let go. Just stop thinking about living in the past, living in the future, living in the present, because it doesn't make any sense. You never will have any conclusion. This is an understanding of letting go.
It certainly is an understanding of letting go, yeah.
Thinking about, I have to do it by the 18th of June, or 27th of June, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Just stop thinking about these problems of being past and future and present. Just be.
You don't get anything of it.
I think it's right, actually. Often the meditation master will tell the student, too much thinking.
Mm-hmm.
The next step is the letting go of all that thinking.
Mm.
Then we get into the being. The being has no question.
Yeah. Okay. Move along. And I think we're about time to have another meditation. So here, our meditation guide for this one. Slightly better than our previous meditation guide. This is Prajnaparamita. So this is a very wonderful sculpture which was done in Java for expressing the essence of wisdom, the mother of the Buddhas. So this next couple of slides is just some miscellaneous bits of information and so on about wisdom. And this is the first one here. In the suttas, what we find is wisdom is talked about in many different aspects, profound levels of wisdom and much more shallow levels and so on. And there's an extremely rich vocabulary that's used to talk about that. So for the next couple of slides, I'm just going to clarify a bit about this different vocabulary. Now what we have here is something like stages of wisdom. We don't find exactly, this is not a particularly systematic set of stages of wisdom. It's not taken directly from the suttas, but each of these aspects is found in a number of places. And it's all kind of, combined in different ways. But generally speaking, the early stages of developing wisdom come from bahusutta, or sutta is learning, okay? So listening. Of course, in those days, it was an oral culture, so listening to the Dhamma. And, of course, the normal thing was that you would listen and memorize. Yeah? So it's not just sort of letting it sort of wash over you in some kind of vague sense, but actually walking away from the Dhamma talk and being able to memorize what was said. Yeah? Much lost quality these days. But it really is possible, if you really pay attention. I had this experience when I was in Thailand about 4 or 5 years ago, and there was a sangha gathering there to do a recitation of the Tripitaka, and they also had some teachings, some Dhamma talks, and at one time they had a timer doing a Dhamma talk, and there wasn't anybody around to translate it. So, or there was somebody around, but then they didn't show up or whatever, and so they asked me to do this translation. So I'm like, okay, my Thai isn't all that good, but I could, as it happened, this particular monk was very clear, and his Thai was nice and comprehensible, and he was very considerate and spoke nice and slowly for me. So that was good. So he talked in Thai, and if you've ever done any translation, one of the things that you sometimes find is that, or if you're being translated, that when you start, that you're very considerate to the translator and sort of say small, simple sentences and wait for them to translate and so on. And as that seems to work okay, you sort of progress and you gradually get into the flow of it and then forget more and more about the translator and just keep on rolling on and on and on and then say, oh yeah, now translate that. Well, this is of course what happened. So by the end of it, he was going on for, 10 or 15 minutes of talking in Thai or even longer. And then he just kind of stop and look at me and then I have to translate it. I never take any notes or anything like that. I never learned how to take notes. I did my 2 years at university. I had less than a quarter of a page of notes for the entire everything. So I have there, and I would just listen really carefully and really mindfully, and I just sit there and listen, and then all I did was listen carefully to what he was saying and then make notes of the different sections in my head. So I'd note, okay, now he's telling this story, now he's giving that teaching, now he's telling that story, and so on. And I made those notes in my mind. And then when it came to translate, then I just said it. And I just would just go and just say the whole thing. And I didn't miss anything out. And I knew that I didn't miss anything out. Right? I could remember what he'd said and I could say it. So it is quite possible to be able to do that. Some mindfulness and clarity. Yeah? It is doable. Human mind is actually capable of some quite amazing things. So reflecting. So when you go away from the talk or you're learning or something, also reflecting about it, thinking about it. So it's not just rote learning, but it's also investigating, reflecting on the meaning. And this, of course, is often what you find in traditional education is as much emphasis on rote learning of things, but very little emphasis on reflection of it. Yeah? And you find this constantly. I think probably many of the people here, say from Sri Lankan background, would probably say the same thing, that they, when they're at school, they kind of learn Dhamma verses and things like that, but you don't actually know really what it means. You're not really taught how to reflect about it. Yeah? Whereas in our modern education system, is much more about the reflection and especially discussion. Yeah. So we encourage kids to discuss about things and so on and so forth. So we learn about that, but not so much on the rote learning. But for Buddhist education system should have some, both of those things are important. So discussion, we mentioned this before, is why discussion is an intrinsic part of this course, is because it's very, very important in how we integrate and absorb the knowledge that we're learning. Applying it to experience, so yonaso manasikara essentially means, so reflecting, when we say reflecting or patisankara is more like a thinking process, so you're thinking about the teachings, whereas yonaso manasikara means more like applying the teachings to your own experience, right? So you hear, sense activity is impermanent, and so you actually sit down in meditation and actually investigate that, say, well, what is my experience like when that happens? And that's very close in meaning to the word we know, very familiar word is vipassana. You could say vipassana means the same thing as yonaso manasikara, but perhaps vipassana might have a slightly deeper sense also of like insight or clear discernment of the truth, but basically a very similar meaning. Then we have knowing reality, yatha bhuta jnana dasana, which Barbara referred to earlier as knowing things as they are, not really an accurate translation, and a bit of an unfortunate translation, because it has, say, if you know things as they are, implies a certain permanence to them, right? Things as they are implies that things are a certain way and they're not another way. Whereas the whole point of this knowledge is an insight into how things change, right? It's actually an insight into the changing of things, not into how things are, but to how things are conditioned, right? And the actual word that's used here, yatha bhuta, the word bhuta, literally means has come to be, yeah? How it has been conditioned. So yatha bhuta literally means understanding how things have come to be, yeah? Rather than how things are. It's a very subtle difference, but obviously a very important one within Buddhist philosophy. And it's a critical line of demarcation from the Brahmanical philosophy, which is always about trying to see some kind of eternal truth. So it's trying to see an eternal state of being, right? Whereas the Buddhist insight is into seeing how being is always changing, how it's a flux, it's conditioned. Now that phrase, yatha bhuta jnana dasana, knowledge envisioned in accordance with reality or in accordance to how things are conditioned, and similar phrases, usually is applied for a stream enterer. So it's usually the vision of somebody as they're attaining the path, the first of the paths, the first vision of the Four Noble Truths. So these other terms we've discussed previously are more preliminary developments, and then the yatha bhuta jnana dasana is usually, it's most commonly applied to the insight of the stream enterer. And then the asavakkhaya jnana, the knowledge of the ending of defilements or the ending of afflictions, is the knowledge of the arahant, okay? So that the stream enterer will know reality, right? They know clearly Four Noble Truths and dependent origination and all of those things, but they're still not completely able to let go of it. They understand it, and they understand this will lead to suffering, but they still want a bit of suffering. They still want to hold on to it a bit, yeah? So this is the stream enterer, but for the arahant, completely lets go of that. And then the other interesting one is a pachavekana or a pachavekana jnana, which comes after arahantship, or in fact after any of those stages. And this is like a reviewing. And one of the things about these different attainments of realizing the Dhamma is that when that happens, you know that something has happened, right? But you don't necessarily know exactly what has happened. Right? You don't necessarily know all the implications of it, right? All the meanings of it. And so following the attainment actually happens in an instant, when you realize the Dhamma, but following that there's a process of reflection and review as to find out, to actually integrate that and to find out exactly what that means. Okay? So typically what actually happens is that if somebody realizes the Dhamma, let's say somebody attains stream entry or something like that, it's such a powerful experience. It completely turns your world upside down, your understanding upside down. And in that moment, and for a period of time afterwards, there's such clarity and purity in your mind that it looks like everything has gone. It looks like you become fully enlightened, and you're not necessarily aware of the remaining defilements and so on that's in your mind. And it takes time for things to settle down and to investigate. And then you see, okay, where do defilements come back in, and where is my mind still lacking clarity or something like that? And then gradually investigate, and you find what work needs to be done. Okay, so here's some different words for wisdom. And these are just basically a list of synonyms. You'll find these various places. Oops, I misspelled vija. There you go, anyway. So panya, usually translate wisdom or understanding. Jnana, knowledge, we usually translate. Basically, it has the same meaning as panya, although knowledge is often used in a plural sense. You can have knowledges, but you can't have wisdoms in Pali. So you can have knowledge of different kinds of things, yeah, but you can't have wisdoms of different kinds of things. Again, it comes back to that idea that wisdom is a more holistic thing. Yeah, knowledge is more specific. Full knowledge, parinya, is usually used for arahantship. Anya, also a word used for arahantship. Dasana, vision. In generally speaking, in Pali, words for knowledge and vision are used in synonymously, okay, or used to reinforce each other. Medha is just another word for wisdom, often used in poetry. And an important one is vija, usually translated as true knowledge or realization. Vija, often applied to the te vija, the three knowledges realized by the Buddha on the night of his enlightenment, which is the recollection of past lives, the knowledge of beings being born according to their karma, and the realization of the ending of defilements, the three kinds of vija. An interesting little etymological snippet is that the word vija, actually the word jnana we have up above, jnana is cognate with the English word know, okay? And the vija is cognate with the English word wit, yeah? And wisdom, as it happens, and various others. But actually vija one of the meanings of vija is esoteric knowledge or science, okay? And in that sense is exactly cognate with the English word wicca. Yeah? So if you look at the spelling of it, wicca, W-I-C-C-A, yeah? Not as in wicca basket, but as in wicca, the religion of the witches, which of course also from vija, right? A witch being a holder or bearer of knowledge, yeah? And so wicca is W-I-C-C-A, as a direct etymological relation to the word vija. And actually vija is used in exactly the same sense. The Buddha sort of adopted it for his kind of knowledge, but vija in the more kind of colloquial sense has exactly the same meaning as wicca does, in the sense of like knowledge of spells or knowledge of sort of herbs and these kinds of things. Okay. So that's just a bit of vocabulary. And now just a few thoughts about what actually wisdom is. You know, bringing on the things that we've learned so far. How does wisdom work? So the first thing I think which is important to acknowledge is that wisdom is not a special faculty, but it's just the developed form of ordinary understanding. Okay? So it's not a special thing that some people have and some people don't have. It's just the ordinary understanding that everybody has developed further. And this is the same with all of the different qualities that we're developing in Buddhism. Right? They're all just things, they're ordinary qualities of the mind that everybody has. And we just try to develop them a bit further, that's all. Okay? So the second thing is, well, what is this ordinary understanding? Actually, understanding is very far from ordinary. And it's only ordinary in the sense that it happens a lot. So we think of it as ordinary. But when we look at actually what it is, well, it's a very curious thing. And so I'll put here, all understanding is an unpredictable knowing that arises mysteriously. In other words, all understanding is intuition. And this is something that's really kind of struck me about the more and more I look at how understanding arises in the mind, it's a very mysterious thing. And even things which we think of as very trivial are in fact very, I think, very mysterious. So I'll give you an example. What's 2 plus 2? So when I ask that question, probably everybody thinks in their mind 4, hopefully. Right? But, and then, where did that come from? Right? So where does the answer, 2 plus 2 equals 4, where does that actually come from in your mind? And most people say memory, but that's just a word for, that's just another word to say, to try to explain something. Okay, let me ask you another question. What's 273 plus 2? Nobody's ever asked you that question before, right? So the answer can't come to you from memory. Where does it come from? You say reason or whatever. But if you look at actually what's happening in your mind, right? What happens is when that problem comes into your mind, there's in a sense there's a tension, right? The first thing is there's a tension. We want to know something very basic to how the mind works is that the mind wants to know. It likes knowing things, right? Absolutely basic. And so when this presented with something, a puzzle or a question or something we don't know the answer to, right, it creates a tension. Yeah? That tension is resolved when an answer appears. Right? And we don't know where that answer appears from. It's just not there one moment and then it is. Right? And we think we know where it comes from. Oh yes, I use maths and I use science or I use my memory or I use something like that. But the actual experience, regardless of how you arrive at it, right? The actual experience in every case is simply that the answer isn't there and then it is. Yeah? That's it. That's how understanding works. There's nothing there and then there is. And when that answer arises, there's a sense of peace that comes with it. Yeah? Right? When you have the problem, that's what it is. Yeah? So it's not purely a cognitive exercise, it has an emotional content. And unknowing and confusion creates tension. Knowing brings that, synthesizes, resolves that tension, and the mind goes to peace. And so that process, I'll come to you in a second, Wendy, but that process happens more or less unconsciously. Even, you know, we can rationalize certain aspects of it. We can think about certain parts, and part of it happens in our conscious mind. But a lot of it actually is just happening unconsciously. And a lot of the times, of course, answers to things come specifically when you stop thinking about it, right? And the more you're trying to, you know, remember, like Barbara in the talk yesterday sort of forgot somebody's name and she said, oh, who is that, who is that, who is that? And of course, you can't remember it. And as soon as you take your mind off it, then it comes. Yeah? So this happens all the time. Right? And the answer arrives in a whole form. Yeah? There's that answer. So these are some of the qualities of knowledge, knowing, which happen all the time, for the most trivial kinds of things, whether you're answering crossword puzzles or anything like that, if you look at how that process works, it's always going like that. You know, reading and understanding a sentence. You know, sometimes you read a sentence in a book, right? And you get to the end of it, you think, hang on, I don't get that. I don't know what they were saying. And you sort of read it again. Ah, okay, now I get it. Right? There's a tension with that unknowing, and then when the knowing comes, it comes to you, and there's a release of that tension. Yeah, Wendy, you can ask some.
At some level, what you're saying, it sounds to me, is this idea of an unsatisfactory experience. So it's like the mind is somehow primed to resolve problems and to find solutions or something like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah, and we have a craving or a desire to know, and maybe Enkong could correct me here, but my somehow I learned, I read somewhere that in the history of psychology that Freud said we're basically driven by the desire for pleasure, and Adler said we're driven by the desire for power, and then Jung said we're driven by desire to know or to understand.
And others come along with the desire to be related.
Many different kinds of cravings, yeah. But certainly, I think that's a very important one. I think that's very fundamental, is the desire to know. Yeah. I think, you know, I've got my new glasses on, right? That's one thing I noticed about this, you know, first time I put these glasses on, you realize how fuzzy everything is and how clear it is and how much nicer it is when it's clear. Right? You actually like to see things that are, you like to know things clearly. I like to be able to look at that clock and know clearly and definitely that we're running out of time, rather than this way. I look at it and think, I'm not quite sure whether we're over time or not. Ah, yes, now I know that we're up. I know that we're over time.
The thing what you said, is it the mind or the brain?
Look, I'm not even going to go into it. From now on, it's just the mind. I mean, obviously it has some relation to what's happening in the brain, but what that relationship is, I think, complex.
At least what you just answered for me is that I've often thought about the fact that the word attention and the word attention sound the same in English, attention.
Oh,
attention.
Right.
Suddenly, what that's made sense of is that when we pay attention to something without resolution, there is attention.
Absolutely, yeah.
So that's how it
will
be.
Actually,
at least
for me, you know,
the same thing. Thank you. So there's a
resolution.
That's resolved now.
That's
good.
Yeah? I've got an unresolved tension.
Okay.
It's been distracting me for quite a while. Where's the sutta where the guy heard the woman singing the sad song?
It's not in the sutra, it's in the commentary.
Oh, right.
And it's a commentarial story which is in the commentarial explanation of the eight precepts. It's talking about the precept of not listening to singing and music and shows, but it says, if you hear it unintentionally, then sometimes it can be beneficial, and then gives this story. Yeah. So that's in the, I can't remember off the top of my head exactly where you'll find it, but yeah, it's in the commentary somewhere. So how does wisdom work? Wisdom is informed by knowledge. Okay, so remember, this is what we were talking about earlier, that there's this information gathering stage. Okay, so beginnings of wisdom, we learn, we gather information, we gather data. It's integrated in stillness. Okay, so all wisdom comes from stillness. And again, this is something which you can see in everyday life at a trivial level, and we see in a spiritual practice at a profound level. Yeah. So obviously the highest level of stillness is the stillness of samadhi, and that's why that leads to the deepest levels of wisdom. But even at a shallow level, we can see that stillness and peace will integrate all that knowledge, yeah, which is that integration which is happening in the background, and then the answer comes. It's accompanied by confidence. Okay, so when you have a knowing, there's a confidence in your mind about that. And the deeper that knowing is, the deeper the wisdom, then the deeper the sense of confidence. Yeah? When the answer comes to you, you know that it's right. Yeah, there's a sense of knowing. So this gets very interesting if you compare with the way the Buddha describes stream entry. One of the qualities of the stream entry is that they have what's called avecha prasada, is the confirmed confidence. But the word avecha, they translate as confirmed, but actually it means the confidence, literally, is having undergone. Yeah? So it's the confidence that comes from having undergone that experience yourself. Yeah? That's right. It's the same, yeah. Yeah, but it's just a different term for the same thing. Yeah. And it leads to peace. So this is the qualities of how wisdom works in Buddhism. Informed by knowledge, it's integrated in stillness, it's accompanied by confidence, and it leads to peace. Okay, so so this obviously peace has different meanings for different people, and so we should probably have our tea break now, and we'll come back a little bit late, so we'll come back at about, I think, 10 past 11 for, I believe, the first discussion group. Yeah.